Today, bond yields rocket higher. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 6th of October 2018. I digested the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The main news this week centres on the rising long-term US bond rates, which signals high interest rates ahead on the capital markets. After the global financial crisis, the US Reserve has effectively been exporting extraordinarily loose monetary policy to markets across the world. And as a result, one of the unintended consequences has been a growing number of asset bubbles around the world, especially in countries where central banks have been forced to run looser monetary policies than they might have wished. But now, as rates lift, how will this unwind and how quickly? And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. The benchmark US 10-year bond rate ended at 3.23, up 0.18%, and the highest than it's been since 2011. The longer 30-year bond rate rose 0.25% to 3.40, again, a recent record. So the question is, does this represent a change in sentiment or just a slight adjustment? Well, the most recent data from the US economy looks pretty strong still, with payroll gains for August revised to 270,000 from 201,000 initially reported, while July was revised up to 165,000 from 147,000. The unemployment rate in the US fell to 3.7%, a level not seen since 1969. But then, does unemployment reaching a 48-year low indicate the economy could be plateauing? An average hourly earnings, an important number to gauge inflation, rose 2.8% year over year in September. But non-farm payrolls only rose by 134,000 last month, as reported by the US Labor Department, versus expectations for a gain of 185,000. This data is about as clear as mud, one analyst noted. And bond yields have surged since the US Federal Reserve added a quarter point to bring US interest rates to between 2 and 2.5% last week, in the third round hike of the year. The Fed indicated another increase in December, and Friday's job numbers were still supportive to the central bank's plan, analysts said. Plus, the consumer credit data, also out on Friday, was also strong, signalling continued economic strengths. So expectations for a Federal Reserve rate increase in December rose slightly to 77.7%. We discuss the impact of these rising bond rates in our post, The Great Bond Sell-Off. And we will have more to say on this later. But it's worth noting the Fed is calling the US economy as sitting in the Goldilocks zone. And they say there are few clouds only on the horizon.
134,000 jobs reported this morning. Do you just kind of throw that out as a hurricane-influenced number?
Well, when I look at the employment report, I see it as one of the many important indicators that we follow. What I see is continued strong job growth. We saw some pretty positive revisions the previous months, and we're seeing the unemployment rate come down. You know, continuation of a really strong economic, strong U.S. economy and good momentum going forward.
Does an unemployment rate of 3.7%, lowest since 1969, scare you?
It doesn't scare me at all. I mean, it's great for the American people, low unemployment, lots of jobs. This is, you know, these are all signs of a strong economy and I think a very good economy. When you think about it in terms of inflation, we're not seeing any inflationary pressures now. So I think this is a bit of a Goldilocks economy, a phrase I've used in the past. Low unemployment, strong job growth, low and stable inflation. This is good.
Yeah, well, the average hourly earnings drop a tenth to 2.8%. The Phillips curve still very flat?
It's, you know, I would say the, you know, relationship between inflation and unemployment is always a little bit more tenuous maybe than we think from our, you know, economics courses we took. But I do see strengthening, underlying strengthening trend in wages, wage growth generally around 3% or a little bit below that, consistent with a strong labor market. But again, I see positive signs there. You know, we're seeing earnings grow, jobs grow, and stable inflation.
Well, when do we see wages rise enough to feed into inflation?
Well, I, you know, again, we're watching for that. I'm watching, you know, the data carefully. We're not seeing signs of that. I think, you know, we're going to, you know, see the unemployment rate continue to edge down this year and next year. I expect unemployment to get below 3.5% by next year. So I would expect to see some continued rise in the wage growth, and that's consistent with a strong economy. So I'm not worried about inflationary pressures, at least for the next year or two. But again, we want to have a, we want to sustain this economic expansion. We want to keep it in good balance. So we don't want to see inflationary pressures pick up. Haven't seen those yet, but obviously watching closely for that.
Higher interest rates increase bond yields, making non-interest-bearing gold less attractive to investors. And they also tend to boost the US dollar, making dollar-priced gold more expensive for holders of other currencies. Despite that, gold rose on Friday, advancing in the bullish $1,200 range and notching its best weekly gain in six, with traders saying it was a sign of the precious metal's return to its status as safe haven reserve of the world. And in fact, the disappointing US non-farm payrolls for September weighed on the dollar and prompted investors to seek alternative assets, including holding bullion and higher yielding bonds. Gold futures were up 0.42% or $5.10 to $1,206.70. And the high of the day was $1,212.30, a peak since August 26. For the week, December gold jumped 1.2%, its best weekly gain since the week ended August the 19th. Gold usually rises when the dollar declines, as it is denominated in the US currency and it's sensitive to moves in the greenback. The US dollar index, which measures the greenback strength against a basket of six major currencies, was down by 0.13% to 95.31 after an intraday low of 95.18. Among other precious metals, silver rose 0.62% to 1468 per ounce. Platinum rose 0.1% to $825, and palladium increased 1.6% to $1,061.80 an ounce. In base metals, copper lost 0.49% to $2.76 a pound. Oil futures were slightly lower, down 0.05% to $74.29, and Bitcoin rose slightly, up 0.65% to $6,635, but remains in the doldrums and is not being seen as a robust alternative to gold, at least yet. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.68% to $26,447. The Nasdaq fell 1.16% to $7,788. And the S&P 500 fell 0.55%, down to $2,886. All reflecting perceived greater risks as interest rates go higher, lifting funding pressures on corporates and dampening demand for consumer goods and credit. Plus, the impact of the trade tariffs have yet to work through. The US Volatility Index, the Fear Index, rose 4.22% to 1482, also signaling that risk is on. Elsewhere, the euro was slightly higher, while sterling surged amid reports that the European Union and the UK were in the final Brexit negotiation stages. The euro-US dollar increased 0.09% to 1.1524, and the pound-US dollar rose 0.74% to 1.3117. The dollar stood lower against the yen, down 0.15% to 113.72. And the Aussie dollar was lower, down 0.31% to 70.53, whilst the New Zealand US dollar rate fell 0.57% to 64.43. The S&P ASX 200 Volatility Index, which measures the implied volatility of the ASX 200 options, was up 1.65% to 11.43. And locally, foreign exchange analysts have trimmed near-term forecasts for the Australian and New Zealand dollars, but they stay upbeat for the long-term outlook, despite the beating the two currencies have taken in recent weeks. A Reuters survey of 55 analysts saw medium predictions for the Aussie dollar cut to 72 cents in the one-month horizon, from 72.75 in the previous poll. But most are still holding to higher expectations around 75 cents, despite the fact the Aussie has shed almost 2 cents since early September to hit 32-month lows. Probably, traders are using the Aussie as a hedge against tensions in emerging markets and the risks to the Chinese economy from the US tariffs. Of course, the sudden surge in US bond yields and hawkish commentary from the Federal Reserve has also driven the US dollar higher, more broadly. And in contrast, the Reserve Bank of Australia has repeatedly stated that its rates will remain at historic lows for some time to come. We see the Aussie-US as a 70 to 75 cents currency for a good while to come, but with risks now skewed towards spending at least some time sub 70 in the next 6 months or so, if emerging market pressures do intensify, said NAB's head of FX strategy, Ray Attrill. In fact, only a handful of analysts in the Reuters poll forecast a fall under 70 cents, and the lowest call was 67 cents in 3 months. "We think this is courageous," to quote Sir Humphrey, given the pressure on the local economy here. Sure, the retail trade figures from the ABS were not too bad, with trend estimates rising 0.2% in August 2018, following a 0.3% rise in July, and giving a 3.4% annual rate. In trend terms, there were rises in New South Wales, up 0.3%, Victoria, 0.3%, South Australia, 0.2%, Queensland, 0.2%, Tasmania, 0.5%, and the Australian Capital Territory, 0.3%. Western Australia fell 0.1%, whilst there was a more significant fall in the Northern Territory, down 0.5%. But residential building approvals fell again, down 1.9% in August 2018 in trend terms. And in seasonally adjusted terms, total dwellings fell by 9.4% in August, driven by a 17.2% decrease in private dwellings, excluding houses. Private houses fell 1.9% in seasonally adjusted terms. The cause is simple: a significant fall in the number of new high-rise residential development applications, especially in Victoria. Recent falls in demand and prices suggest a significant reduction in momentum is on the cards there. And we discussed this in our post, Building Approvals Dive, in August 2018. Turning to property, CoreLogic said that last week, 895 homes were taken to auction across the combined capital cities and returned a final auction clearance rate of just 45.8%, the lowest clearance rate that we've seen since the week ending the 10th of June 2012, where it was 42%. Of course, it was a long and sport-laden weekend, so we should not take the data too seriously. Melbourne auction activity was subdued last week, with just 70 homes taken to auction and returning a final clearance rate of 57.7% across 52 results. There were 608 homes taken to auction in Sydney last week, returning a clearance rate of just 43.8%, the lowest clearance rate the city has recorded since December 2008, and the sixth time this year the clearance rate has fallen below 50%. Across the smaller auction markets, clearance rates improved across Adelaide, while Perth and Tasmania saw no change in clearance rates week on week. Of the non-capital city auction markets, the Hunter region was the best performing in terms of clearance rates, with 6 of the 11 reported auctions selling at 54.6%, followed by the Gold Coast with 32.3% clearances across 31 results. The number of homes scheduled to go to auction this week is set to rise across the combined capital cities after last week's public holiday and grand final slowdown, with CoreLogic currently tracking 1,725 auctions, almost double the volume last week. But do not expect too much good news on the clearance rates. And the September data also confirmed prices continue to fall, with national dwelling values falling 0.5% over the month, making 12 months of consecutive falling values across CoreLogic's National Hedonic Home Value Index. Dwelling values tracked lower across five of the eight capital cities in September, while five of the seven rest of state regions recorded a fall in values over the month. CoreLogic's head of research, Tim Lawless, said, "While the housing market downturn is well entrenched across Darwin and Perth, where dwelling values remain 22.1% and 13.2% lower relative to their 2014 peak, Sydney and Melbourne are now the primary drag on the national housing market performance. They want to highlight, though, that this is not a crash, saying that since the national index peaked 12 months ago, dwelling values have fallen by 2.7% and a slower rate of decline relative to the previous housing market downturn from June 2010 to February 2012, when national dwelling values fell by 3% over the first 12 months, declining 6.5% from peak to trough. But the difference this time is tighter credit. That has changed the game, as we will show when we release our latest household survey results next week. And averages mask the 22% falls plus that we're seeing in some places, especially among high-rise apartments. Here, some banks are now not lending at all, or only on very much reduced valuations. The AFR reported this week, for example, that the developers of Brisbane's 92-storey Sky Tower, led by AMP Capital and Bill Bergier, have hired lawyers Norton Rose Fulbright to pressure the valuers to upgrade the new valuations for the apartments, which they now say are not fair. The bank's willingness to lend for apartments has been crimped by APRA caps on lending and the Bank Royal Commission. They are now cracking down on the valuation of newly built apartments where they were once willing to lend. And the AFR also reported that a major bank has a blacklist of 6,700 apartment projects across Australia where buyers are refused loans or are offered reduced loan-to-value ratios, according to mortgage broker Home Loan Experts. And PIMCO said this week in a report that Australian housing prices have fallen for 15 consecutive months. The nationwide all-dwelling price index was down 2% year-on-year in August, with Sydney prices down 5.6%. This was Australia's first nationwide housing price decline in 6 years. To be sure, prices remained 40% higher than levels in 2012, when abundant credit supply and strong foreign demand began powering the market. But these factors seem set to reverse over the cyclical horizon. Falling home prices and rising debt servicing costs, lower discretionary income, and negative wealth effects, which may constrain household consumption and therefore prevent the Reserve Bank of Australia from hiking its cash rate from 1.5% for some time. This is the basis for our more conservative view of a lower neutral rate and a benign environment for Australian bond yields. We also expect, they say, Australian banks to be negatively affected given their large exposure to the housing sector directly and indirectly. The probability of an agency rating downgrade has risen. And the HIA also reported that total new house sales declined by 2.9% in August, following a fall of a similar magnitude, down 3.1%, in July, saying that new home sales, home building approvals, home finance, dwelling prices, vacant residential land sales, and the various relevant sentiment-based indices are all pointing to another year of contracting levels of new home buildings in 2019. This is consistent, they say, with our forecast, which also reflects our expectations that the declines will occur primarily in the eastern seaboard states and be most pronounced in the main areas of New South Wales and Victoria. And of course, the RBA kept the cash rate on hold this month, as expected, with little change in their narrative and an expectation that rates will be unchanged for months ahead. But of course, the pressure to lift rates will increase as US rates rise, putting more pressure on the Aussie. The question will be whether the RBA will be happy to let the dollar slide and so lift inflation, or lift the cash rate and risk imposing more strain on household budgets. They are completely caught. I still think the next move will be lower. As inflation rises, a momentum in the economy eases. Already the construction sector is in trouble, as I discussed with property insider Edwin Almeida. You can watch our video, More from the Property Market Frontline. The draft report from the Royal Commission got more attention this week as people worked through the 1,000 pages or so of its content. But my initial reaction has not changed. This will tighten lending for property further, not least because of the need for the banks to be more rigorous in their expense analysis to ensure that the loan is suitable. We discussed this in our post, Is HEM Dead? And our recent video. The risks of class actions against the banks have risen. And we got a glimpse of the pressure on the banks when the Bank of Queensland released their full year results this week. Their cash earnings after tax were $372 million, down 2% on financial year 17. And the statutory net profit after tax was $336 million, down 5%. Being a regional is a tough gig, and they continue to drive significant digital transformation. But despite some accounting wizardry, the cracks are showing in our view. The tighter home lending sector and reduced fee income both hit home. As a result, capital is weaker than expected. And home lending is under pressure, with this flowing directly to their bottom line. Their shares ended the week at 10.79, down 2% on Friday. On the other hand, the other regionals, Bendigo and Adelaide Bank, rose 0.57% to 10.59, and Suncorp rose 0.35% to 14.40. Among the majors, Westpac was up 0.37% to 27.90. ANZ was up 0.40% to 27.72. National Australia Bank was down 0.15% to 27.21. And CBA was up 0.11% to $70. AMP, who was hit hard by the Royal Commission, sits at 3.08, up 0.33%, as at the close of play on Friday, but way off its April levels. The ASX Financial Index ended the week up 0.36% to 6,040, whilst the broader ASX 100 was up 0.2% to 5,084. We suspect there is still more downside on the banks. As we discussed in our video with Robbie Barwick, the vision thing, how to reconstruct our banking system and make Australia great again. You may not agree with all the points he makes, but I think the questions posed are really important. Finally, a reminder that on Tuesday, the 16th of October at 8 p.m. Sydney time, we are running our next live stream question and answer event. The reminder is up on YouTube, and you can send me questions beforehand or join in the live chat. So mark your diaries. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. As always, if you like what you've heard here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst, Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.